Hey, it's Scarp. I've been blessed to have an incredible career in journalism, politics, and media. Along the way, I've made a lot of friends and a few frenemies. So we thought, why not turn on the mics and see what happens? Welcome to Season 2 of Scarp and Friends. I'm living my best life. We're really lucky today to have a friend of the show, a friend of Arizona, a real leader in our state, Danny Seiden, CEO and president of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Danny, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Scarp, and congratulations on a very successful campaign season for you. I don't think enough people are talking about who really had a lot of success last week. There's a lot of people out there claiming victory for things, but it's pretty clear that everything you worked on, more you had the Midas touch this campaign season. So we're lucky to work with you on Proposition 312, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But you did the Senate Victory Fund, which was very successful for President Peterson. And you helped with Juan Ciscomani, which ended up being maybe the most important congressional race in the entire country for the Republican Party. So big night for Daniel Scarpinato. So happy to be on to celebrate with you.
Thank you. That's very kind. But it was also a great night for you because you were involved in a number of issues, helping certain candidates, wanted to get pro-business folks across the finish line. So tell us about some of the success that the Chamber had as an organization, because you're focused on policy, but having good policy means having good people and sometimes getting policy done at the ballot.
Yeah, no, and you're right. It was a great night for the Arizona Chamber. It was a great night, I would argue, for people who want to see government do their job. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what the Chamber wants. You know, we absorb our members' problems, and most of their problems involve government not doing their job. So I think we had a lot of success around that. But let's go back. We've talked about this before, about 3 years, right when I was coming into this mm-hmm. job. You know, I think I gave my opening address to the membership in saying that the business community had kind of lost its base. We didn't, you know, for years and years and years, the business community found a true base in the Republican Party. And I think blame to be shared on what happened there, but the Republican Party went more populist. The business community, you know, either shied away or didn't engage like they used to, or kind of got involved in some social issues that certain people saw outside of their lane. And I think they paid a price in their political support. So 3 years later, we've been, you know, for the last 3 years, I should say, we've been so focused on staying in our lane, so focused on everything that we work on at the Capitol or at the ballot is justifiable by our bottom lines. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're here for. We're not here to tell you how to raise your kids. We're not here to tell you, you know, like how to be a better parent. That's not what we do. We're here to make sure that you can get a great job in Arizona, that, and with that great job, you can get a good education, you can raise a family and everything else. But, you know, we don't get into, we don't cross over what's not in our lane. And I think that really paid off. I think, you know, it's easy to say it's because we recruited better candidates, but in reality, we worked harder. Courtney Coolidge, Grace Appleby, and our advocacy team worked really hard at, I would say, meeting with members, educating them what our issues were, where we were. And I think we built up a new level of trust with the existing caucus, as well as new members who were running for office. So we kind of built up a new base. And it is a bipartisan base. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of our big bills, whether it was saving the Commerce Authority or anything else, look at the vote tallies. It's very interesting. You know, plenty of Democrats, a lot of Republicans. But I would say we were able to kind of rebuild a business caucus, people who care about the economy, and that matters.
You kind of need that now, don't you? Because there are factions in both parties. When you and I don't know if everybody knows how much experience you have in this space, because you've been involved in public policy at the Capitol for a long time. You were the lead guy for Bill Montgomery when he was county attorney. That's when I first met you. You were very active at the Capitol, obviously working for Governor Ducey, working in the private sector, working for Intel. And so you've got government experience, you've got private sector experience, and so you've come at this from a few different standpoints. But I feel like, you know, a decade and a half ago, it was kind of like, okay, you know, you just line up the Republican votes and do it. But now you really do need, you need to get votes on both sides.
100%. And you should be able to. I think the cause, you know, whatever this uniparty nonsense is floating around out there, move that aside. You should be able to build a caucus of people who care about your issue. Like, you know, it should be a battle of policy. And is this policy good enough to win Democrat votes, Republican votes, and get the governor to sign it or get the people to vote for it? And right. that's the kind of fights we want to be in. I think we've had a lot of success with that mentality. But yeah, it's the landscape has changed and we have to change with it. What we can never change though is what our core principles are and start to do things like trading access for outcomes. I think that's how you lose relevance. If you're an organization that sees a shift in your state, so, you know, 2 years ago, people could have put an elephant on a poster and said it's, you know, a missing endangered species, right?
Right.
Republicans are on the way down. Arizona's becoming a blue state. A lot of groups are like, we got to go as Democrat as possible.
A lot of them did that.
We got to hire as many Democrat people as we can, regardless of what the outcome would be for that, regardless of what we can do for our members. We did not do that. We maintained that what we want to accomplish, which is making Arizona the most competitive place to do business in the country, that is true across all party lines, and we will fight for it no matter who the governor is, no matter who the legislature is. It was very easy for groups like us when you had a governor like Doug Ducey because he came from the business community. When you have a governor who has a different background, like Governor Hobbs, who came from the social working side, we have to work harder at making sure we're advocating our positions in a way that she understands. And I'll be honest, I feel like we've won that office over more often than not on our issues.
Well, I think that the groups that have tried to just play the politics of the moment, that's a risky thing in a swing state like this, because we're going to have a pendulum that swings. We're going to have leaders on both political parties. And if you stay focused on the issues and the policy, like you're saying, your North Star, your principles of what's best for your members and for the people of the state, rather than getting sucked into the partisan politics, you're going to long-term have a lot more success.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way of saying it. And I think we saw it in this state, we're a swing state, but we also saw it nationally too. You know, look at how much power swings in D.C.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people thought there would be a complete Republican takeover of the Senate, the House, and the White House right now. So I think those groups who were trying to bet on the politics are going to be paying a little bit of a price right now in terms of their relevancy. Now, other groups, they're like, it doesn't matter who wins the House, the Senate, or the White House. We're going to fight for what we're going to fight for. I mean, a really good example is a month ago, we were in meeting with Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo about you know, how we can better fund and streamline the CHIPS Act money that's coming into town. And this morning, when we're recording this, TSMC received $6.6 billion. And that's huge for national security.
Wow.
That's huge. That's something that, you know, started way back with Governor Ducey in 2017 and has just really started to pay off now. So we're meeting with her at the very same time, Scarp, that we're suing EPA over overly burdensome air quality regulations for pollution that we're not even making in Arizona. You should be able to do that. You should be able to have disagreements, but find things you can work on together with all sides.
So looking ahead to policy in this upcoming year, and let's talk about state first. You guys are involved, as you pointed out, in a lot of federal policy. I want to get your read on some of what we can expect there as well. But in terms of the state level in Arizona, so the election's over, Republicans remain in control, picked up a couple seats. I've made the case that I think actually having, you know, we dealt with one seat majorities. It's really tough. Everybody is the emperor, you know, everybody is suddenly can kill anything. And so having a little bit more breathing room, having some folks from these more centrist districts who are more maybe have run on working with both sides, who are focused on maybe some more bread and butter issues like education, transportation. Is that, do you also see this as a positive development? And then what are some of those things that are on your list that you think could actually get done and get passed in the current world order in Arizona?
No, well, I'll try and hit both those questions in order. I believe that the biggest mistake the Republicans can make right now is to get overly arrogant, to sit there, you know, spike the football and believe that they have, you know, a forever mandate to just be elected and be entitled to be in office. If you are not governing, if you are not leading, someone else will. If you leave that, you know, if you leave a vacuum, it will get it will absolutely get filled by someone else. And that's why this Republican majority, I really hope that they come up with their agenda. It can't just be, we want to make Governor Hobbs look bad. We can't just be like, how do we score points on Democrats and run up the score? Because again, I'll point to all kinds of races. People want government doing their job. You know, for all the Republicans who complained about 479, it passed pretty convincingly. I mean, it would cross the 60% threshold if it needed to. So they want roads. They want infrastructure. You know, 312 is a good example. 312, the chamber led on, we worked with you, and they want local governments to enforce laws. They want to protect private property in right. neighborhoods. So those are real agenda items to work on. And I hope they lead on that. I hope we can formulate a real leadership of these issues that matter to the state and the economy and education. Whatever it takes to raise a family, real issues that are out there. Because if not, someone else will. If this just becomes about politics, that gets really old really fast. And that's why the pendulum swings so much. I mean, we had, before Governor Ducey came in, when you and I were working in down there on other things, Governor Brewer had supermajorities.
Right.
So it's not that long ago that there were supermajorities. So the fact that we picked up seats doesn't necessarily indicate this is the new direction we're going to go. We're going to be entering a midterm year. Reverse coattails will be in full effect. And I hope they're working and leading on something. And here's a couple of things they could focus on to your second question, and that is Prop 123. You know, 10 years ago, Governor Doug Ducey, at the time of our worst financial crisis of our state, needed to find a way to better fund education, to settle a lawsuit, and to distribute funds more without raising taxes because we just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So you know, he went to the land trust, decided it was just, you know, the distribution rate in the threes was too low. He raised it to 6.9%, took it to the ballot, won a very close election, as you know. And over the last 10 years, it's put billions and billions of dollars without raising taxes into K-12 education. However, it expires next year. And there is yet we have yet to see a real agreement on what could be referred to the ballot that people would vote on. You know, several people in the Republican side have an idea to make it go right to teacher pay, which turns into this very complicated bonus because of how that stuff gets calculated, and it's a dangerous way to do teacher pay. And we learned that in the Ducey administration during the teacher strike, that when you involve yourself in teacher pay, when it's always been done at the local level, it's challenging. So we'll be working on trying to get the best plan to voters to help bridge that gap, because we're talking about billions of dollars to K-12 education, and people do care about that. Just because it's not front of mind today, you know, a year or two, you know, if you see another teacher strike, it will matter. So education. Second, there is a lot of talk about what childcare costs in Arizona.
And yeah.
People are always surprised to hear the chamber talking about this, but it's a labor and workforce issue. And I'll give you an example. If you are one of the, if you are under certain thresholds of income, there's a lot of programs for you to get assistance so you can still work. And if you're, you know, in a very wealthy bracket, you don't really care because you can cover those costs. However, if you're middle class, if you're the hardworking middle class that make up, you know, the heart and soul of our state, the cost of childcare is almost $23,000 per child right now. That's crazy. That's more expensive than sending them to college. So we have to find a way to get a solution here. You know, if the market is failing, we have to really figure out, is there a policy that's missing? Is there something we can do to incentivize, a solution here? Can we reduce liabilities? Can we reduce burdens and regulations to allow for more kinships? There's a lot of different ideas we're kicking around. Governor Hobbs, I believe, will have some leadership on this. I hope the Republicans in the House and Senate do as well, and we'll be working on that with them too. And then honestly, we have to keep addressing our growth. Energy is a big deal yeah. in Arizona. You know, we're the youngest state in the Great 48. We have one of the best grids, most reliable grids in the country. It's a fairly affordable grid as well. But to accommodate all the manufacturing, all the data centers, everything else that's essential to not just Arizona's economy, but the national security of the country, we have to build out more infrastructure. We have to invest in that. And we're either going to do that through raising rates at the Corporation Commission or I think some very, you know, savvy grants and legislation to get investments in capital outlays and new innovative ideas around cogeneration with some of these investment funds too. There's a lot of ideas out there, and we just have to be innovative. Those are all things we should be working on.
Yeah, well, and the Prop 1231, to me, it's so fascinating because we worked down there through the recession, the Great Recession. We inherited a budget deficit when we came in. It took us a long time to get out of that in the Ducey administration. And now when I bring that issue up to some people on both sides of the aisle, they're like, oh, well, we've already backfilled that money and we don't need it. And it's just incredible to me that you would take, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year and just do nothing with it. because there will be other, I mean, we've already seen changes in the budget. It is a, the one thing about it, and so much of what was said about it proved to be wrong now that we're 10 years into it, it is an incredibly reliable revenue stream. So the fact that you would just kind of shrug your shoulders and not do anything to renew it, I think, is actually kind of irresponsible.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm just, as an outsider, this is Blake. What do you think Governor Hobbs has to do over the next 2 years to put herself in the best position to win? And I'm talking legislatively. Like, what does she need to do over the next 2 years to put herself in a position to have a chance in 2026?
Producer Blake is trying to get me fired with these questions. No, I kid. I have a hot take, and Scarp's heard it, that, you know, and I think the Republic and everyone else disagrees, but I think we know historically what I'm about to say is correct. One of the winners of last Tuesday night is Governor Hobbs. Mm-hmm. Because if you are an incumbent governor and you're running against the opposite party at the top of the ticket, you get the reverse coattails effect. It's already really hard to knock out an incumbent governor. Given those circumstances, I think that the political landscape got a lot better for her keeping her job. Now, what does she need to do to make a case? You know, let's say Governor Deuce used to say this is a job interview.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go stand in front of the voters in 4 years and I'm going to say, here's what I told you I would do. Here's what I did. Here's my metrics. I think she needs to, one, keep her strong focus on the economy and keeping that, you know, we can fight over who's responsible for the economic momentum we have in Arizona, but she can keep it going. She can keep pouring on the gas. She can fund things that work. She can fund things that have ROI to it. And I think so far she's shown a willingness and an openness to that. I think leading on Prop 123 will be a big moment for her because she has to address education funding. It's a big section of her voting base for sure, but it's also something that people will be paying attention to. Wait a second, we've had Governor Hobbs for 4 years and K-12 lost Prop 123. We did this, and no matter what, you shoulder the blame a little bit when you're in the governor's office. So I think if she can lead on Prop 123, which I believe she's going to attempt to do, you know, it's going to come down to the legislature, I think that would be a good case for her. And then honestly, I think she has to get out more. I think she has to show, again, you might disagree, I think she, you know, when you're ever with the governor in small settings, fun personality, you know, engaging. I think she has to get out and demonstrate that a little bit more. She, you know, she's going to these ribbon cuttings. She's getting out there on the economic stuff, and that's good. I think she's got to, you know, put her notes down a little bit and let her personality shine through. And I think people vote, you know, the Barstool test is real. They vote for the person they would rather have a beer with. Apparently, you know, that was Governor Hobbs over Carrie Lake, you know, 2 years ago. Who will be next time? I don't know. So I think she's got to let her true personality come out a little bit, and I think that'll benefit her. So, and here's probably the most important one. I don't want it to sound like I'm criticizing her, because Scarp had a really good point. From Jump Street to start that late at taking over a governor's office after an incumbent 8-year governor, that's no easy task, but she was already got a late start. So it was really tough for her to put together a vision, an agenda, and to govern. But, you know, the executive has all kinds of levers of power. The only one we ever really hear about is veto, but we know that's not true. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to do so much. And I think if she finds, like, you know, finds her groove on ruling as a strong executive over the next 2 years, governing as a strong executive, I should say, I think that would benefit her too. It benefits the state, you know, I'll put it in business terms. She is the state CEO, and we want our CEO to be successful because that makes the state successful. So I think if she finds her groove, and there's a lot been said about the improvements that Chad Campbell has made to the office, and, you know, we're excited to work with him going forward. He just spoke to my group yesterday, my membership yesterday. He's very optimistic about their relationships with the Republicans in the House and Senate. I hope that's true. I think that was before the announcement that Senator Hoffman was just reappointed to Dino, and these confirmation things are going to continue to drag on. So she's got her work cut out for her with that legislature. But again, the more political they behave and less leadership and governing, the easier it is for her to begin to look like the leader and the adult in the room. And I think that benefits her as well.
Yeah, you know, I think you people really underestimate how important it is when you're an elected official in Arizona to just constantly be out there. I think this was a challenge for Senator Sinema, where there's so many new people coming here all the time. People are from other places. They don't have the affinity to politics here, like in Iowa or, you know, some of these states where people have been there for generations. They know who Chuck Grassley is. We saw this a lot with Governor Ducey, where we had to just constantly be out there, constantly getting around the state, constantly doing interviews. And I always, one thing that just always stood out for me why I used the cinema example, because I was a fan of a lot of what she did. I know you were. But I think that, you know, I would have liked to have seen her out there more talking, doing interviews, doing town halls, because I think she had a story to tell about what she was working on. And I don't think a lot of people heard directly from her. They heard about the media and activists and stuff talking about her. So I think your point actually is a good piece of advice for anyone in office in Arizona, particularly in statewide office. It's good advice for Ruben Gallego as he gets started to, you know, go get around, go on television news, go on morning shows. We did that a lot with the governor, and you would see it in the numbers. You'd see it in the polling numbers when we weren't as aggressive. People just forget. It's like things just fall into a black hole.
No, hire a videographer.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. That's a really good point about Senator-elect Gallego. You know, who we've had the opportunity to work with both Senator Sinema and now Senator-elect Gallego through the years, going back to their time in the state house. And it's interesting to see how they've each migrated. Now, I love the policy stances the Senator Sinema has taken. And I don't know if it was something that during COVID that just changed the nature
right.
of how politics worked for her, because she was a very good retail politician. And so to see her back away from that. But also, you know, I'm going to defend her for a second and say the way the media attacked her,
yeah.
you know, for the position she took on the filibuster, the lack of support she got from people who are supposed to be the referees calling balls and strikes out there. That is, it's asinine and it's unforgiving. For Lori Roberts to write this article, and you know how I feel about this. She wrote an article, you know, saying that we all owe cinema a thank you. I mean, how dare you? You know, how dare you do that now after she lied? That's what you should have wrote before. Instead, the head of your page wrote a story comparing her to the KKK, saying she destroyed and eviscerated Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. Just absurd. That was our paper of record. That's what they were saying about her then. So if I was cinema, maybe you start to feel like, I don't want to be out in public. I don't want to be out in public with that kind of vitriol being thrown at me. But, you know, again, here's another hot take for you. She deserves a statue. Like, Senator Sinema preserved the republic. You don't have to agree. You can disagree if you want. What she did with the filibuster.
I'm not for statues of living people.
You can push back if you want. But you know what? We have 9 Supreme Court justices because of Senator Kirsten Sinema. We have 50, you know, states because we have 100 senators, I should say that way, because of her. She held the line when the party that was in power decided they were going to try and change the rules to keep themselves in power. But she said, you know, we might not be in power a couple of years from now. This is not the way we do this. And she's been proven right. We knew she would be proven right on that anyway. But it just goes to show, I mean, real leadership, real political courage, it's tough to find sometimes. So when someone like Senator Sinema does what she does, I think it's worth, you know, I think it's worth celebrating.
Well, look, I think you're right. I mean, I remember her being chased into the bathroom. And so I think that it would have been tough for her to be out there, possibly in a way that I'm suggesting. I do think she could have made her case more aggressively. But while I disagreed with some of what she said and did during COVID in particular, I think she does deserve a lot of credit. I really think you've framed much of it right. And I thought the event that you had with her earlier this year, and you did a Q&A, I just really walked away being like, wow, you know, this did take a lot of courage. And she really did walk the talk on even hiring Republicans in her office. I mean, I actually think she's one of the only examples of somebody who truly said, I'm going to try to be post-partisan. And there is a path there. Yeah. I have pointed out, I think it'll be interesting for Senator Gallego because he's now succeeding 2 one-term senators who kind of got railroaded by issues within their party. And I think it'll be interesting to see how he positions himself as his senator on votes, messaging. He's got a real different brand than she does. But it'll be fascinating.
I asked him. He came to the chamber, and I asked Senator Gallego some of these questions. First, of course, I said, let me give you a scenario. It's a hypothetical. And no one thought it was going to happen at the time. Republicans take the Senate. by, I think I said by 50 or 51. Mm-hmm. They take that, they keep the House and they take the White House. And then the people supporting President Trump want to do away with the filibuster. Are you and Chuck Schumer going to all of a sudden flip your positions? Because you're both on the record saying to get rid of it. And he's like, I know to be consistent, I have to say yes, but there are reforms to the filibuster you could do. So the equivocation had kind of started then, but I think you can see the writing on the wall that, you know, Sinema did a really good job of this one thing, exposing people for this principle that if you're in power, what you say or do is right. And that can't be what you stand for. And she kind of, like, I think, shined a light on that. You know, the history of the filibuster is really funny. Whichever party's in charge seems to not like it. You know, it's measurable. So for her to say this forces this body, this United States Senate, which, by the way, is supposed to be the greatest deliberative body in the world. It's not, you know, don't underestimate how important the United States Senate is. I mean, it is known to be the greatest deliberative body in the world. By keeping the filibuster and the votes that she made it so they still have to come together and talk. They still have to come together and negotiate and forge compromise. And that's part of what America is, which is why I'm so high on what she did and why I think she deserves a lot of praise for it. Because, again, it was real courage to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, I think Senator Gallego is going to follow your advice on this. From what we've seen, he'll go anywhere. He'll take just about any talk show he can get on to defend his positions, to get out there and let people know where he is on things. And I'll say this too. He's given us some good glimpses at how he'll work with the people in the business community. You know, he was with us on asking EPA for some guidance. He was with us on organized retail theft, a big issue for people in Maricopa County. So I'm going to be optimistic and say maybe there's, the Senator Gallego will reflect that good independent streak we have in Arizona.
Well, we've known him a long time. You've known him a long time. Actually, I used to do trivia with him at George and Dragon many prior lives ago when we were in our 20s.
If you tell him that you beat him in trivia, yeah. George, we did our DC Flying. I said, I think I beat you in trivia. He's like, that never happened. He doesn't let go. He's a smart guy for sure.
He's a really smart guy. Yeah. So he's definitely, I think, he has a much more progressive record. Sinema had one at one point in time, but I truly think she morphed over time into the person she was. So he's a smart guy, and he is a smart politician. So we'll be watching at what develops there. I did want to ask you, because I think you have a unique perspective on this. One of the narratives out of this election is the fault line around educational level, college education, where we have seen this big shift where, you know, people with college degrees are more likely to vote, were more likely to vote for Vice President Harris. People without college degrees more likely to vote for President Trump. There are a lot more people without college degrees than with them. And it feels like part of what we're seeing is that there has been such a focus from a public policy standpoint now for decades, probably our whole lives, around a post-industrial economy, technology economy. We've seen it in Arizona, where a lot of the discussion, like in the 2000s, was C-suite jobs, corporate headquarters, almost kind of diminishing the service industry, call centers. And it does feel like a little bit of what we're seeing in our politics is people saying, we've had enough. And I guess my question is, you know, how do you see that, and how do you kind of address that from a Chamber of Commerce perspective around, when we talk about workforce, when we talk about employment opportunities, and the fact that there are a lot of people who feel like they've been left behind by public policy leaders?
You know, this probably will sound more controversial than I think it should be, but I think one thing that President Trump did, and this addresses your question really well, is he opened the tent up. Mm-hmm. You know, now I'm sure there's, you know, certain demographics who would disagree with that, but the numbers tell a different story. Right. He really opened the tent up. And I think for a long time, the GOP became very elitist. You know, mm-hmm. you had to have a college degree. You know, the people who we really look up to, the Buckleys, these like high level thinkers, I love them. I mean, But they're not telling a story that a lot of people who are in the trades, who own their own business, you know, who are really this the what makes this country run. I think we got disconnected for a while. Maybe they didn't feel welcome anymore. And one thing this Trump campaign has done is it really opened that tent back up and said, you're welcome here. Mm-hmm. There's a place for you. You're what makes America great, to almost use this whole slogan, right? I mean, he seemed to acknowledge that. And that's exciting to see. And I think we can kind of learn from that. You know, when we're talking about chamber events, we can't just be when we're talking at chamber events, we can't just be talking about big businesses, the C-suite, the CEOs. They're not the boardroom of America. They don't make decisions. You know, they don't know better than everyone else. They know their bottom line really well. They know what's happening in the economy and their sectors really well. But you need entrepreneurs. You need tradesmen. You need manufacturers. You need people who build things, who engage with these workers. And I think we have to reexamine our education models. You know, Chad Gessen, someone who we worked with a lot, former Phoenix Union superintendent, now he's got his own company, and he's focused on this. His dream is to reinvent the K-12 model so that no one gets left behind, so that we don't have to stick everyone like they're in a factory. You get here, you have to follow this model. Attainment to the higher university should be your number one goal. That's not it anymore. It should be more, okay, this guy has entrepreneurial skills. He wants to be, you know, could be in a trade. Identify that and get them a path that works for them where they're still able to graduate and then go on to a successful career. And I mean, they're going to be running the country. Right. You know, I think it's better now to be a welder than an attorney. No offense to my profession. I mean, the getting that entrepreneurial, getting that entrepreneurial story down really matters. And I think we can do a better job of it in the Republican Party. And I think, again, Donald Trump really showed, and people are like, well, why would he know? He's a billionaire or this, that. He might be a billionaire, but he went and talked. He did, laugh if you want. Tell me that McDonald's thing didn't make a difference. For him to go sit there, get in line at McDonald's, that makes a difference. You know, yeah. That's the kind of thing that can backfire. It could be Dukakis, you know, with a goofy helmet on, right? You know, but instead, it worked. People believe because that was their guy. And we know he eats McDonald's. Right. So I think reconnecting with the workers of this country, not the unions, because that's something different, but the workers, the workforce that makes up those places, I think is really important. I think he did a good job of that. I give him a lot of credit for bringing blue collar voters back to the GOP. Now it's incumbent upon all the ones who are elected not to lose them.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about that, we've seen some announcements come out of the administration, and you know, federal agencies have a big impact on your yeah. members and businesses in Arizona. And so, are there bright spots? Are there things here that you see as a positive shift?
Yeah, I think like any administration, there's always going to be you're going to have challenges with different agencies from time to time. But I can tell you, my members are very excited about former Congressman Lee Zeldin going to EPA and the statement he put out, because in his statement, he acknowledged that economy is part of people's health as well, that be able to have a job and not shutting the American manufacturing workforce down, having it go over to Southeast Asia where they don't care about the environment the same way we do, would be a mistake. He seems to recognize the complicated interactions of the economy and environment, and that's exciting to us. That's mm-hmm. very exciting to us. So that's one big bright spot right away, because we are in, you know, the chamber, full disclosure, active litigation right now with EPA over their one-size-fits-all air regulations, punishing us for air issues we don't control. So I would say Lee Zeldin. Then I would go right to Governor Doug Burgum, who was just announced for yeah. Secretary of Interior. Matters a lot to Arizona. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have a lot of control of our own land here. And to have a business guy like Governor Burgum, who we know very well, you know, yeah. he came in very shortly after Governor Doug Ducey did. Mm-hmm. So we got to meet him through the RGA process, and you've worked with him more since then. But a tech guy, understands energy because of the state he comes from. I mean, I'm very excited about him.
Brilliant guy.
You know, right, yeah. I mean, this pick is not being celebrated enough, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. I think we should be talking about it more. But looking at what President Biden did with Interior, the way he designated a monument in this weird checkerboard fashion to try and block all kinds of uranium mining, even though we can do ethical uranium mining now, that's what generates electricity. If not, we have to buy from foreign. I think having Governor Burgum come in, I'm very excited about him. Very eager to see what happens with commerce. You know, there's a lot of rumors out there. Very eager to see what happens with energy. We do have a need to invest in our energy generation here and domestically. So I think those picks are being watched very closely. But there's, I mean, Senator Rubio from my you know, my original home state of Florida to be Secretary of State, his for all the talk about, well, President Trump loves dictators, I'll tell you who doesn't love dictators: Senator Marco Rubio. And I don't think President Trump does either. The point being that pick signals that he takes foreign diplomacy seriously. He takes a strong American presence in the international world very seriously. And, you know, just go listen to Senator Rubio's comments on the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel. Listen to what he says about Venezuela. Listen to what he has said about Cuba, right next to his home state. He knows the pain that's inflicted by autocrats on a country. And I think he has a passion for America being that shining light to the world right now. So I'm excited about him. Yeah, there's some other ones that we're curious about. You know, they're interesting picks. I, you know, we're not in on all the conversations, so I don't know why they're being made, but maybe there's a reason we don't see. But like I said, I think for the most part, people are excited right now. Solicitor General announcement was an exciting one to a lot of us. So we'll see how they all shake out, and we'll see how confirmation goes. One question that I'm starting to wonder, you know, I'm counting on my fingers over here. If he keeps appointing House members, what happens to the slim majority that Speaker Johnson has? Because
did you see Johnson joked about that?
And I missed it.
He said, you know, I'm begging and pleading with President Trump, please, enough already. You know, I won't have any members left.
And you know, it's funny because you can tell that there's a lot of new people to politics. Like, well, the governors will just appoint people. I'm like, that's not how it works for the House. It's a special election.
Why is that? Months. Is it because the Senate used to be done through the legislative process, and that just was never up? So a lot of states have that as the. I've always
you know, it's in the Constitution, right? I mean, it's that. I think one. It keeps the House closely associated with the people. Uh-huh. And, you know, it is the House of Representatives. They have to represent that population. So I think if you get back to some of those original documents, that's why that idea works that way. Whereas the Senate was more representative, less representative, but more broadly in the Republic sense representative. And I think that's why it's worked out. But I think you're correct. Probably when they changed the rules for the Senate, they didn't address the House. And I think on purpose, though. Yeah. I think on purpose. Yeah.
Well, I've been on a big kick against seed oils, so that's one thing I can agree with RFK Jr.
I don't, you know, the one thing I'll say, you look.
Now, I don't know that they need to be federally banned, but I've banned them in my home.
Yeah, I mean, Republican Party used to be the party of personal responsibility. So if I don't want my kids drinking soda, I'll tell them not to drink soda. Right. I don't know that I need RFK to do that now. I will say the disruption idea, listen, we have a terrible national deficit. We have to make a lot of changes. So this whole Elon and Vivek Department of Government Efficiency getting in there and looking at true waste, fraud, and abuse, and they're going to get in there with a wrecking ball. Is it scary? Maybe. But is it needed? Yes. I think
something's needed. There's layers and layers and layers. Even I saw even where there's they said how many agencies there are focused on getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, and they haven't done it. So there's so many layers of government. I mean, we saw this at the state level. You can only imagine at the federal level.
There's a Kevin Kline movie called Dave. You know, I don't know if you ever saw it, but he brings his friend, who's just a schmaltzy accountant, Charles Grodin, in to help solve the budget when he's pretending to be president. And he's like, well, I don't know why you're giving, hundreds of millions of dollars to look at a study on shrimp or hamsters, and just starts Xing things out. That's how I vision this Vivek Elon thing going. They're like, you know, gone, next, next, next. And that might be necessary because every one of those programs, as you know, has a constituency.
Right.
And if these two folks can be immune to that constituency, immune to the bureaucracy that we deal with all the time, right? You know, what's one of the toughest fights we had in the Ducey administration? The cosmetology schools. You know, I mean, you think you can... We want to make it easier for people to have a job, get rid of get rid of overly strict licensing. Whew. That was one of the toughest fights we ever had. And, you know, again, these entrenched bureaucracies and their constituencies are a problem. So maybe this Elon Vivek thing will really work out. We'll see. I'm eager to see how it plays out. Excited with some of the picks. Like I said, I'll keep going back to EPA. I'm really excited about Lee Zeldin. I think, again, the time is now. If you want to, to make America the number one country for producing its own goods, for manufacturing, you cannot have EPA slowing you down. And again, it is illogical because you're making the air worse if you just send it over to countries that don't monitor, that make worse emissions anyway. So that's, again, lots to be excited about. And it's really needed, too. One thing we didn't say, I should say at the beginning of the show, federally, back in 2017, right, President Trump passed the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which lowered the corporate income tax rate, lowered taxes for everyone. That spurred this industrial revolution, I'll call it, that we're seeing in America, even more than the CHIPS and Science Act, which came 2 years later. That was the first step that did it, but it made us more competitive. Something that Ronald Reagan did in the 80s and had only gone up since then. So to lower that back down made us really competitive again. And that's set to expire in 2025. So the fact that the Republican Party controls all houses in the White House, I feel a lot better about that, the chances of that extension.
So you've got a big anniversary coming up for the chamber, a big event coming up for the chamber, a lot of events, but one that's close in the pipeline. So talk to us, 50 years of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, just a bit about the history and then kind of what you're doing to celebrate that and leaders of the past.
Yeah, no, you're right. So December 5th, we're doing our Heritage Awards, and this year it's Governor Doug Ducey and Governor Jan Napolitano are dual recipients, and it's going to be a celebration of the past of Arizona as well as kind of the present to future. So you have a past governor. I don't think they've ever been on stage together. Troy Hayden from Channel 12 is going to be doing our moderation for us, so we're excited. It gets me out of the hot seat with the two of them. He can ask some fun questions. And I think it'll be interesting to hear over two governors who oversaw huge growth in our state, which both Governor Napolitano and Governor Doug Ducey did. But, you know, we are going to use that night to kick off the celebration of our 50 years. And if you look back on what this state has accomplished, we're building this timeline out right now, and it's amazing. Where the chamber has had influence, where we've been able to help us grow, going back to 1975, fighting for better tax regulations, better infrastructure, just in general, keeping right to work in the Constitution, all the amazing things the chamber has done, getting the income tax just a couple of years ago down to 2.5%. Those are all huge wins. It's really exciting to be part of that kind of history. And at a time when I think a lot of organizations struggle for relevance and struggle to go to your members and say, give me money because we throw a couple of events. Well, we say, invest in us because this is what you get back. You care about the state, you care about what we're doing for the state. And this 50 years tells the story of what we've been able to do and really kind of sets the course for what we're going to do. You know, our vision is definitely bigger than our organization and our goals and our budget or anything else. So getting people to invest with us is really exciting. And I told this story yesterday, I'll say it again. You know, there's some debate over where the first state chamber of commerce was in the country. Some say Charleston, but I'll go with Boston, which is the other one. And that started because a group of harbor and dock owners in 1773 did not like regulations coming out of England. And so they decided to form the Chamber of Commerce, which met at the Boston Public Meeting House, which led to a public affairs campaign called the Boston Tea Party. So, you know, since we're all in public affairs, that's one of the very first things a chamber ever did. So, I mean, the relevance of a chamber from the time of the Revolutionary War to right now has never been more important. We just have to make sure that we're staying in our lane, that we're telling a good story. We don't allow our belief that someone's too far left or too far right to stop us from going and sitting down with them and making our case. And we've made a lot of good friends along the way. You know what everyone really cares about? Well, good paying jobs. And so we have a good story to tell. We have good relationships we're building up, and we're going to continue to do that.
So the people, if anybody who defines themselves as Tea Party wants to attack the Chamber of Commerce, they should do their history.
We funded the Tea Party. We funded the original Tea Party. That's right. Although someone said, of course, you know, well, didn't they dress up like Indians? And that's you probably shouldn't say that. No, the Boston Tea Party is a thing we celebrate. So, yeah. It's good. No, we're proud of the history of chambers in this country. I'm always worried when I see a chamber. I think trading what we would say outcomes. Trading away outcomes to get access. In order, they want to be as best friends with the new elected officials they can, so they sell out some of their members' positions. We'll never do that. You know, you always have to be able to justify why you're doing what you're doing. I think, you know, since I've been there, and I think honestly since Glenn was there, we've been able to do that.
Do you know why the Arizona Chamber started?
It's such a good question. So at the time, it was the Arizona Association of Industry, you know, it's one of those things where you can find some of the older gentlemen in town to get versions of the story. Like, well, it was an elected official and he needed a job, so we created a thing for him, which is not very exciting. Then you look at who some of the first, you know, the original board, which consisted of Arizona Public Service at the time.
Yeah.
And they were having issues with regulations of utilities. I mean, Arizona has always been an interesting state because we have this, you know, elected corporation commission, which only, 13 other states do. And it was meant to, like, push down on monopolies and everything else. So they were very eager to have the legislature understand in order to get growth, to fund this growth we're starting to see. 70s was a good growth period for Arizona. To fund that growth, we really have to have good policy. So looking at who was the original investors, you can kind of piece together. Some of the original issues were infrastructure, talent, growth, energy, the same thing, education, same thing we're fighting for now.
It's actually almost kind of surprising that it was only 50 years ago, yeah. but I think it probably just shows what an outpost we were for a long period of time, that it was just like people would come here on vacation or something.
And you know what it was? This speaks to the whole Kingdom of Maricopa thing. There was regional chambers before that time period, but there was never one unifying state chamber. And I think that was because people viewed things as like, well, Phoenix is all there is, or Tucson is all there is. So, as you know, we take a very big statewide approach to everything we do. You know, we go to battle in Flagstaff, we go to battle, and you went to battle in Yuma this year.
Yeah.
We fight up and down all across our state. It is a great state. It's worth fighting for. You know, until someone is setting a different vision, we're happy to stand in the gap and fight for Arizona to become the most competitive place in the world to do business.
Awesome. Well, Danny, thank you. I think a lot of people who are trying to anticipate how to navigate the legislature, the federal transition, will find this really helpful.
I hope so. Thanks for having me on. I would just say, yeah, keep an open mind. You know, this people forget how fast the resistance formed last year. So 8 years ago, it was instantly. We had to fight this guy on everything he did. And I think that's a mistaken mentality. I think instead, have an open mind, see how we can work together, see where we have mutual interests, and let's go. You can disagree with RFK if you're making Cheetos, but you can support Elise Zeldin because you know you want things manufactured in America. I mean, there's ways to get along here. And I think that's true at our legislature as well.
So. Cool. All right. Thanks a lot, Danny.
Appreciate it. I'm living my best life.